Good morning, everyone, and welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You. My name is Leah M., and I'll be your moderator this morning. Today is Sunday, October 26, 2025. The share ID numbers for Friday, October 24th are the following. For the 7 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 22,897. That's 22,897. And for the 10 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, that's 22,898. This morning, A Vision for You presents the False Summit. In step one, we conceded powerlessness, the realization that we are doomed. The mental obsession condemns us to pick up that first bite, don't want to, and the phenomenon of craving condemns us to continue eating once we start. This happens over and over and over again. We are not effective on our own power. Our personal history of suffering has demonstrated that fact, not just with respect to compulsive overeating, but also with regard to our unmanageability, to our living a quality life. Through continued pain and suffering and constant defeat, we come to the realization that we must embark on the spiritual journey of the 12 steps in our search for a spiritual awakening. Thus begins our desperate and deliberate search for an effective relationship with power through the application of the 12 steps. Although this power, this fundamental idea of God, is deep down inside of us, our book says it may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, or by worship of other things, perhaps by vanity, perhaps by people, relationships, money, or various schemes. These impediments ensure continued deterioration and darkness. Recovery is a process of spiritual growth and a continuous climb. There is no summit, there is no peak, no graduation or finish line in recovery. Recovery is full of opportunities for growth, adversity, and challenges. The mountain of recovery doesn't become smaller. We just become better climbers. Every stage of recovery and growth brings with it new experiences, new perspectives, and personal insights. In the end, the goal of the journey of recovery isn't just to reach the summit. It is to become the kind of person God intended each of us to be of maximum service to God and the people about us in the roles he assigns. Joining us today to elaborate on this topic is Kelly G., a recovered compulsive overeater from Florida. Kelly is dedicated to the 12-step way of life and to carrying this message of recovery. And it's with great appreciation that I welcome Kelly G. to the line this morning. Good morning, Kelly.
Good morning, Leah. Thank you so much for that beautiful introduction and for asking me to share this morning. It is such an honor. It is such an honor to speak and be asked to do the special edition. And I just remember just sitting and listening to these meetings, being like, oh my gosh, these people that are sharing these amazing lessons and teachings on Sunday morning. And today it's me. And yeah, it's funny. One of my best friends, she had a baby, her first daughter, and she just remembers there was so much chaos, and she looks around and is trying to find the adult in the room, and she realizes she's the adult. That's kind of how I feel. I'm so reminded, like, I grew up in this program. You know, I'm the adult. I'm the one who has to do this footwork. So I wanted to first give a little context in terms of why I chose the False Summit. And this is what's really cool about this program and about the spiritual connection and way of life is that I had no idea what the title is going to be. And, you know, when I'm asked to do this morning's presentation, it's, I just want to be enlightened and think of a title that sounds clever and catchy. And I couldn't think of what it was for days. And then one morning, 6 a.m., I'm prepping breakfast to leave for work, and I'm just like, the Fall Summit, like just like that. And that doesn't roll off the tongue, but like it did, because I kept seeking God. And I kept asking God, what should I talk about? What should I talk about? And the hard part about the spirituality aspect of this program and about the way of life is that it's not immediate. When I was asked what the title was going to be this morning, I wanted to be jolted into a title. And it took a couple days. And then when I got the answer and got the title, it was like, whoa. Like, that was not me, because I had no idea. So anyway, to give a little summary of why the Fall Summit came about is it refers to the time in my recovery or our recovery when we think we've made it, that there's, you know, we're at the top, right? And then there's always something else to learn. There's always more growth that needs to happen. And there's new heights of spirituality that need to be reached. And I'm a metaphor person. So I love metaphors. And this is, Janet B is great with the metaphors. So if she's listening on the line. But so this is where I'm going to start. Growing up, I was a hiker. Every family vacation, I hiked. And that's how I ended up in Florida, because I never went to Florida on those resort sun-kissed vacations. I was always in the mountains hiking and sweating and full of dirt and going to the bathroom in the woods. And I remember we had walkie-talkies. My brother and I had walkie-talkies connected to my parents. And I remember seeing the summit of the mountain, and the summit is the top of the mountain. And I'd be like, oh my gosh, we're finally here. And I would look up at the top and I'd be out of breath, huffing and puffing. And then we get there and then we look up and we're like, wait a minute, that's the top? Like, so this, and it was like, oh my gosh, we have such a long way to go. Like, we're already depleted. And then we get there and I'll never forget, this mountain had like 3 false summits. And I'm like, this is absolutely crazy. And I was like, I just want to stay here. This is high enough. The view is great. I'm done. But then inside of me, I was like, but no, like, I want to see that. I want to see that view. So anyway, I find this very metaphoric in terms of my recovery, in terms of the big book, in terms of the journey, right? And it's so corny. Life's about the journey, not the destination, right? We've all heard that a million times. But when it comes to recovery, it really is so true, because we can work the steps and we can feel like we have that spiritual awakening because we did, or we realized we didn't. And we feel like we've made it. And it's like, but wait, this is as good as it's going to get. Like, this is it. And come to find out, like, no, there's more. There's a higher level. And so I want to talk about, I'm going to start in the beginning if everyone has their big book or not, close your eyes and just listen and something relates, amazing. But I want to talk about first the pink cloud, right? So if you're new and you come in and you've never really heard of this program, Overeaters Anonymous, and you realize, okay, if I don't ingest the sugar and flour and I follow a food plan, this is great. I'm feeling better. My mind's getting clearer. I have a little more energy. I can do this. This is called the pink cloud of recovery. So people come in. They're like, this is the best thing ever. I love it. I hear people on the line. I relate. I call them. They're nice. I can talk about anything. That is the pink cloud of recovery. That's not to put a damper on those emotions that happen that when you first come in. And sometimes they don't, right? You can come in and be like, this is the worst thing ever. Like, I have to do this forever. Like, this is my life now. I can't unlearn that I have this disease. I can't unlearn that I'm going to have to do this dance. But what I can do is I can stick with it. So however you're feeling, whether super excited or overwhelmed and defeated, doesn't matter. It gets better. So things that happen in the pink cloud of recovery for me was I come in, the scale goes down, and then I feel like I've made it, right? So I'm doing this dance, the scale is going down, I'm feeling good. I'm like, this is the program. This is great. And there's many things in my life that gave me a false sense of superiority, a false sense of I'm on the top, I'm looking down. That used to be me, but now I'm here. And the first thing is not in this order in terms of the potency of it, but losing weight. That was always an indicator that I've made it. Job success, big indicator, making a lot of money. Huge, then I definitely feel superior. Relationship status, I've got the guy, I've got the man, I'm taken. Attention, people are looking at me, I look good in my clothes, I'm getting higher in my company. Material things, I'm wearing the diamond earrings, I'm driving the car, I live in the apartment or condo on the water in Florida, always have a tan, right? I have arrived. I'm at the top. Now, little do I know that those material things and that false sense of superiority is what makes me fumble. It's what keeps that pebble in my shoe. You know, when you're walking and all of a sudden you're wearing your sneakers, your socks, you're like, the last thing I want to do is bend down, take off my sneakers, roll down my sock, and try to get that pebble out. You've got to be kidding me. So you're like, no, I'm not doing that. And you keep walking and you realize, like, all right, I got to do that because I can't stop thinking about that pebble in my shoe. And those five things that I've listed, right, in terms of losing weight and job success and money and relationship status and attention and material things. Those are my pebbles where I can rest in those. I can ride those out, right? I can start hiking towards the top feeling like I'm going to make it. But then the discomfort happens when I realize that, you know what? Nothing matters because I'm still miserable inside. Those are all Band-Aids. Those are all illusions that give me the feeling I'm enough, that I'm worth it, that I can fake this whole dance to the rest of the world. I can appear a certain way when inside I'm dying. So on page 2 in the big book, what Bill is experiencing is that work taught me, took me about Wall Street, right? So Bill's working on Wall Street here. And Bill's saying that people lost money. He became rich. Men of genius conceived their best projects when drunk. He's feeling the adrenaline. He's feeling the adrenaline of disease. And I know that so well. I know that, you know, when I'm on that sugar, when I'm on that spree, I can convince myself of anything. I'm indestructible. And slowly but surely, he realizes that, you know what? This is the weapon of mass destruction, that he is going to have this boomerang and be cut to ribbons, right? So what does that mean, the boomerang? And I always share this story. I think I probably shared it on the last special edition I'd done, where I was at the beach with my mom. I was younger, thank God. But I could easily do this same thing, as an adult. But anyway, I was digging this deep, deep, deep hole in the sand, right? Like any kid does. And my mom's like, Kelly, don't do that. Someone's going to fall. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, how is someone going to fall? It's this huge hole. Like you can see it. And I remember going to feel the water and I'm walking back to the blanket. And guess what? I fall into the hole, right? So I am the boomerang. I fall into my own hole. And that's what I tend to do in life. When I am stuck in that feeling that I have arrived, that things are on this upward path with the wind that's carrying me, that's full of those material things and chasing that high, I know it's a matter of time that I'm going to fall into that sand hole that I dug, right? So on the bottom of page 2, Bill talks about the geographical move. So he says, we gave up our positions, and this is he and his wife, right? So we take people down with us. We gave up our positions, and off we roared on a motorcycle, the sidecar stuffed with tent blankets and a change of clothes, and 3 huge volumes of financial reference service, right? So how many self-help books did I read? How many you are enough, all these quotes that I would put on my mirror and I would have on my phone. Now, granted, if you do that, great. It's not a bad thing. But for me, it was that I was trying to chase the solution, trying to chase something I didn't even know, right? Ultimately, it's chasing a moving train. You're never going to catch up. It's always going to be moving. I can't outrun this disease. Our friends thought a lunacy commission should be appointed. Perhaps they were right. This is top of page 3. I had some success at speculation, so we had a little money. But once we worked on a farm for a month to avoid drawing on our small capital, that was the last honest manual of labor on my part for many a day. We covered the whole eastern United States in a year. At the end of it, my reports to Wall Street procured me a position there and the use of a large expense account. So here it goes back to those characteristics of superiority that I was talking about, right? So now Bill has this big bank account. So now he's got power, right? Because he's got the money, he's got the job working on Wall Street, and the exercise of an option brought in more money, leaving us with a profit of several thousand dollars for that year. And that filled his cup. And granted, that would fill my cup too. When I have that spiritual hole inside of me, I will grab onto anything to stuff it, to fill it. For the next few years, fortune threw money and applause my way. I had arrived. My judgment on ideas were followed by many to the tune of paper millions. The great boom of the late 20s was seething and swelling. Drink was taking an important and exhilarating part in my life. The last sentence of that paragraph, I made a host of fair weather friends, right? And so that was me. In high school, I won in the yearbook Biggest Smile. And that could not be more of a compliment to my acting skills, right? Where it's like I was going to college to be a teacher for education, but really I should be an actress because I pulled it off. I showed people and I faked them out that I was happy, that I was always smiling. And little did they know, when I got home, I was a monster. I was a monster to my mom. I was a monster to my dad. I've punched holes in the wall. I have had my dad call the police on me before because I was just out of control. Like, I was an absolute tornado, but I was the best smile. I was the best smile. So then page 3, right? So Bill had arrived. He's had some success, right? Now we move over to page 7, where it talks about my brother-in-law is a physician, right? So on page 7, My brother-in-law is a physician, and through his kindness, the first full paragraph, and that of my mother, I was placed in a nationally known hospital for the mental and physical rehabilitation of alcoholics. So now Bill realizes he has a problem, right? He realizes that he's not okay. The money's not going to cut it. And I jumped over a couple pages. So the pages that I skimmed over is just how, you know, Bill relapses, right? Bill's like, you know what? I've arrived. I've made it. I have all the money. And the powerlessness comes where he loses all the money. And he's in a worse position because this disease is progressive. And yes, we have a disease. And that word was so scary to me in the beginning, because I think of disease as something medical in terms of, I don't even want to say, right? It can't, whatever it is, disease. But this to me, it was like, I have a food problem. Like, it's not, addiction is so extreme. It's like, whoa, I have an addiction. But it's like, no, that's what it is. That's exactly what it is that I have this disease and it's never going away. It's never going away. So now Bill has the best physician and he is in the best nationally known hospital for mental and physical rehabilitation. So under the so-called belladonna treatment, my brain was cleared. Hydrotherapy and mild exercise helped much. Best of all, I met a kind doctor who explained that though certainly selfish and foolish, I've been seriously ill, bodily and mentally. So it's like, okay, his brain's cleared, right? And I've been to treatment centers where my brain gets cleared. I'm in great hands. I have the best therapist. And it relieved me, the next paragraph on page 7, the second full paragraph, it relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other aspects. So right now, Bill's learning about himself. He's like, oh, okay, now I understand it. You know, I can be successful at work. Things can be going well. I can have friends. But when liquor comes to play, I'm weakened. So he's gathering knowledge. Right? And so he thinks knowledge is power, rightfully so. That's all he knows. My incredible behavior in the face of desperate desire to stop was explained. Understanding myself now, I fared forth in high hope. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. Now, this reminds me of when I was hiking, right? And I just remember the trail, we'd hike really steep, and then all of a sudden, it would just be flat, and then there was some downhill, because we'd be approaching a river or a lake or something before a steep incline. And when we were going straight and then going down, I was like, this hike's so easy. Sometimes I'd start running. I'm like, I just want to get there. And little did I know that this was just self-knowledge. 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high, right? I get this temporary reprieve where it's like, okay, now I understand what's wrong with me. Now I'm good. Full steam ahead. But it was not, for the frightful day came when I drank once more. The curve of my declining moral and bodily health fell off like a ski jump. This is not Bill's fault. This is not your fault. If all of a sudden you come into program, you're like, oh, right? I have the allergy of the body and I have the powerlessness and the obsession of the mind. Got it. That's what I have. Self-knowledge right there. I know what's wrong with me. But that's not enough. That's not enough because I'm going to eat again. It's what I'm going to do with that self-knowledge. And it's the understanding that understanding is not the solution. I can define what those words mean. I can give examples of how it's present in my life. But it doesn't matter because that's not going to get me anywhere. It is not for the frightful day when I drank once more, the last full paragraph on that page. My weary and despairing wife was informed that it would all end with heart failure during delirium tremens, or I would develop a wet brain, perhaps within a year, right? So I'm on borrowed time here. I'm dabbling, right? What do I have as a foundation? I have self-knowledge. I just saw the best doctor, right? I had money, so I know I'm capable of it. I lost it all. I'm telling my wife, you know, don't give up on me. Then I'm warned by the doctor, you know, that I, you know, the consequences. But that doesn't scare Bill. He welcomed the idea. Oh boy, did I welcome the idea when I would just keep going and going and going, eating, hurting myself, feeling the pain. When somebody told me that diabetes was going to happen, that none of my clothes were fitting, that my ankles were swollen, that my face was so puffy, that I'm waking up in a puddle of sweat, that nothing fits, that I don't want to be seen, that my depression is at skyrocketing heights, right? When I'm alone, when I don't want to be with anyone, when the sun shines too bright, I just want the blinds down. Everybody's irritating me. It's everybody's fault. I want to pick a fight with everyone. And if somebody is happy around me, I despise them, right? That was my life. I welcomed the idea of not waking up in the morning. Then I remember thinking, you know, this, just a side note, whenever I was hiking, I'd hike next to my mom sometimes. I have a brother, so it was like the boys and then the girls. So my mom and I would talk, and I always wanted my ears pierced, and I had to wait till I was 10. And I remember I was approaching my 10th birthday, and I would, you know, the hike would be so hard. And so my mom would try to distract me by bringing up topics that I want to talk about, like, you know, what do you want to do for your birthday, and who should we invite? And then we were talking about my ears getting pierced, and I was so excited. And she's like, well, what kind of earrings do you want? And at the time, I don't know if it's still a thing when you get your ears pierced, but I was like, I want my birthstone. And my birthday's in July, July 17th. And my birthstone's ruby red. And we talk about it, and we'd be like, ruby, or should we do like amethyst, or should I do emerald, right? And so it was distracting me. And we kept hiking, and it just helped me get through, right? Like a crutch. And I remember the day I turned 10 and I got my ears pierced. And I remember the woman putting on the dot on my earlobe and where she's going to pierce them. And I was started crying. And so the owner of the store came over, and she put the earring in. And I remember when the first woman put the dots on my ears, she goes, well, on this left ear, I'm going to pierce it on the top of the dot because they weren't fully even. But when the owner came over, because I was kicking and screaming and nervous and making a scene, she pierced it in the center of the dot like any normal person would. And they've never been even. And it drives me nuts. And granted, years later, because I am a perfectionist, I fixed it. But in the same token, it's like I'm faced with a distraction, right? It goes back to material things. It goes back to something that I want. Anything that I want, once I get it, it dies down. And I just remember, it's like I got what I wanted. I wasn't satisfied. And it was like anticlimactic. Like, okay, now I have my ears pierced. I can't even feel it. What difference does it make? I have no more friends than I did prior. Like, what difference does it make? So I needed those distractions. But it helped me to get through, but it's temporary. Now we turn to page 12. And on page 12, Bill starts thinking again, right? And that's trouble. I know for me, I'm starting to think a problem. My thinking gets me nowhere, but Bill starts thinking again. And the second paragraph is, well, to give context, Bill's starting to think about this higher power, right? Because we realize that we're powerless. The self-knowledge isn't doing it for us. You know, making money isn't doing it for us. Clearing our head and thinking, oh, okay, you know, I'm free of this obsession. My body's feeling better. Not doing it for us. We can go for a day. We can go for 3 months. And then we're hit in the head again. And once again, if this is your pattern, it's not your fault. And I was so confused when I heard that from people in the program that loved me. Didn't even know why they loved me, but they loved me and they would tell me that it's not my fault. And I was like, yes, it is. I'm the one doing it. I'm putting my hand to my mouth and I'm eating it. But then I realized that I was really powerless over it. And the only thing I had was to believe that there was a power greater than myself. And so Bill's friend suggested on page 12, the second little paragraph, my friend suggested what seemed to be a novel idea. Why don't you choose your own conception of God? And next to that phrase in italics, I wrote exhale. And I love things that make me exhale, right? Because it's like, oh, like I can do that. Like that's all I have to do, choose my own conception of God. Then from page 12 to 15, it's about the trail of recovery for me and the trail, the hiking trail, right? So first Bill is going to decide or understand or realize or have this realization from his friend that, oh, I can have my own conception of God. And God is concerned only with humans when we want him enough. So I need to realize that I can choose my own conception of God. It can be whatever it is, but I know that I need it, that there is nothing else that's going to work. And at that point, Bill was like, I need and want God. So there's worldly clamors, right? There's things that are going to get in our way. And it's the chatter. It's the noise. It's almost like we live our lives and inside of us is this little demon and it has our voice and it's loud at times and it's noisy and it has this script that it reads. It's kind of like subtitles, right? And we're reading them, but we're trying to ignore them and sometimes they're loud and sometimes they're quiet, right? And that's what happens a lot of the time when I'm not in the spiritual realm of life. So when it talks now on page 13, it says, there I humbly offered myself to God. And this is step three, right? I humbly offered myself to God on page 13, the second paragraph, to do with me as he would. I placed myself unreservedly under his care and direction. So what's really cool about this part of the book is that Bill's path is not linear, right? But I want to say that every time Bill would go back to the drink, it's not like he's starting on the bottom of the mountain. It's that we can still go forward even if we think we're going back. Because thank God that Bill had those up and downs. Because number one, today we can relate to it. And number two, it got him to this place right here and right now where he is willing to unreservedly, right? Because he knows with no hesitation that there is no other option. That under the care and direction of God, that's all he had. So I had admitted for the first time that of myself, I was nothing and that without him, I was lost. So Bill was still moving forward this whole time to get to this point, right? It's like he got to this first summit. This is the top, but he keeps going. Then he realizes that he has to have the willingness to admit that he is wrong, right? So this is step nine. It's these steps are in order for a reason. So in this section, right, from 12 to 15, it's very condensed. So without him, I was lost. Step three, got it. Then next sentence, I ruthlessly faced my sins and became willing to have my newfound friend take them away, root and branch, right? So his sins, he's faced with that inventory that comes in step four, where it forces us to take a look at where have we done wrong in life? Like, what is our part? And take them away, root and branch. We're not looking for the Band-Aids anymore. We're not looking for the first aid kit. We're looking for the surgical removal of these sins, right? Of these defects, of these past behaviors that keep us hating ourselves. Then, as we step through, he's telling this to his school friend, and he admitted his problems and deficiencies. And that's step five, where we turn to somebody that we trust, usually a sponsor, doesn't have to be, and we share this inventory. We're like, this is what we did. We bring it to the light. Six and seven also comes about in sharing those defects, sharing those experiences that we've had. Those, I want to say regrets. They are regrets. At the time, they aren't. But then I realized, whoa, I wish I could do things differently. The defects are revealed. What's getting in my way? What aspects of myself keep me stuck? And then he makes a list of those people that he's harmed, and he's willing to make such matters right. So God consciousness, the second to last paragraph, common sense would thus become uncommon sense. I was to sit quietly when in doubt, asking for direction and strength to meet my problems if he would have me be. So now build in the flow, right? He's on the path. He's headed to another height. He were to sit quietly and when in doubt, asking only for direction. Bill wants direction. He realizes he doesn't know the way without a higher power. So bottom of 13, my friend promised when these things were done, I would enter upon a new relationship with my creator, that I would have the elements of the way of living, which answered all my problems. And this is where I was. I needed you all to promise me, if I do this dance, I'm going to have relief, that I'm going to have a stronger relationship with God. I'm going to have a better life. My thoughts are going to be rewired. My personality is going to change. Everything. I needed to be promised that. Because if somebody told me, you most likely will have a spiritual awakening, you should probably feel better. No, wasn't good enough for me. Didn't work. So now I want to talk about page 22. Where it says, hang on, turning to my big book, page 22, the last paragraph. So it talks about, we know that while the alcoholic keeps away from the drink, as many do for months or years, he reacts much like other men. We are equally positive that once he takes any alcohol, whatever, into his system, something happens, both in the bodily and mentally sense, which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. So now we know this deal where I can't have food, I can have food. I can't have sugar or flour in any form, because now I know that bodily and mentally, I can't stop. The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this. And the steps are in the order for a reason, absolutely. But I do step one every single day. Every single day, I am convinced. I know who I am today. I know that I'm a compulsive overeater. I know that I can't stop. And I know I can be off to the races at any second. So these observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in the mind rather than his body. And, you know, it's kind of corny, right? But it's like, if I truly believe that I can't do something, then I can't do something. You know, I'm in a relationship now, and I've never really had healthy relationships, and I'm in the common denominator to blame for all of that. And it's like, in my mind right now, currently in this new relationship, it's like, if I continue to tell myself I'm never going to be healthy in a relationship, then I'm never going to be healthy in a relationship, because that's where it starts. Now I want to go to page 26. Just a little side note. There's in Maine, if any of you live in Maine, there's a national park called Acadia National Park. And the highest mountain in Acadia National Park is called Cadillac Mountain. And I used to hike it every year. And what's cool about Cadillac Mountain, which I think is kind of uncool, is that you can either hike it or drive it. Believe it or not, they made a path where you can drive it. And I think someone might be unmuted because I hear someone. But I was always so resentful at those people that drove it, right? Because the sun would be setting and I have dirt on my pants and I am like exhausted and my hair is a mess and I'm just sweaty and dirty. And these people are all dressed up about to go to dinner after they see the sunset on the top of the mountain. And I was like, that's not fair. That's not fair. They get to drive up and see the most beautiful view. And I just spent 3 hours hiking this thing. And guess what? There's always going to be an easier, softer way, right? There's always going to be a way where you think that you can just skip a couple steps. What's the big deal, right? But for me, I don't have that luxury today. Also, I don't want to, because anytime I think I'm taking the shortcut, I'm actually taking the detour. And what's cool about some of these mountains and the trails is that sometimes the path isn't fully clear. So there's these little, forget what they're called, but there's these little mile markers that sometimes have like a little rock formation that shows like, oh, this is the way. And you have to look for it. It's not just going to, they're not in neon. A rock is a rock, which it blends in with the other dirt on the trail. So you got to keep your eyes open. You got to look for it. And those little markers are what keeps you on the trail. And for me, it is such a metaphor for my life. Like when I don't know where to go, I don't know what direction to go. No, there's not going to be a little rock pyramid formation, right? But there's going to be sometimes that inner either turmoil or inner peace, right? And that could be my mile marker. My mile marker can also be picking up the phone and calling a fellow and realizing, you know what? That's exactly what I needed to hear. That was my mile marker, right? Keeps me on the path, keeps me on the beam. Then we go to page 26, where you hear examples, right, of a certain businessman. First paragraph on 26, businessman who had the ability, had a good sense and high character, right? So here's someone who thinks he's made it. He sees the best psychiatrist, right? He learns all the knowledge in the world, right? But then he fell off the beam because it goes back to knowledge, and that's not going to work, right? We turn to page 32, and the big book gives us examples, right? Real-life examples. I want to hear it. I want to hear the real the hypotheticals, right? On page 32, it talks about the second full paragraph, a man of 30 was doing a great deal of spree drinking, right? So back to the drinking, but it doesn't mean he's going down the mountain, right? It doesn't mean that when we pick up, we're going down. It just means that we're on a detour and it's part of our story. That's all. A man of 30 was doing a great deal of spree drinking. He was very nervous in the morning after these bouts and quieted himself more with liquor. He was ambitious to succeed in business, but saw that he would get nowhere if he drank at all, right? So business is also the higher power here. Money. he would not touch another drop if he was successful, right? An exceptional man, he remained bone dry for 25 years and retired at the age of 55, right? So then he fell victim to the belief, which practically every alcoholic has, that his long period of sobriety and self-discipline had qualified him to drink as other men, right? And I don't have that luxury. No matter how much time I have under my belt, I don't have the ability to eat like other people. I don't have the ability to munch in the movie theater. I just went to the movies the other night for the first time in forever. And I went with a group of people and they're passing around the popcorn and just chowing down. It's almost like when you eat at a movie theater, like none of it counts. Like nobody knows, nobody can see you. No one's really looking at you because they're looking at the screen. But it's like, oh, it counts, because guess what happens after the movie? All the lights come on. You walk to your car. You realize, ew, like I just ate all that, right? And it's like, I don't have that feeling anymore. So then page 33. Brings out the lies that we tell ourselves, that most of us have believed, the first paragraph on 33, most of us have believed that if we were to remain sober for a long stretch, we could thereafter drink normally. That's the lie, right? But that voice that tells us that is in our own voice, that is in our own brain, is that subtitle that we're reading and we're believing. But then it says, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic, right? So that's the truth. So it says the lie, and in the same paragraph, it says the truth. If we are planning to stop drinking, there must be no reservation, nor any lurking notion. And that's what these ups and downs were in the beginning for Jim, for Bill, right? It's we need to know that in order to have no reservation. Right? We needed to gather our own data, our own case study, and put it together. So then I want to move to page 35 and 39, right? So this is about Jim. These are just examples, and I can't believe how much time is flying. I hope you feel like time is flying. But our first example is Jim, right? So Jim is a man, has a charming wife and family, right? So he has it. So far, he has it good. He's a good salesman, right? And then he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. So we told him what we knew of alcoholism and the answer we had found, and he made a beginning. His family was reassembled, and he began to work as a salesman of a business he had lost through drinking. Right, so this is a humble pill where Bill used to be the head of this company, and now he's just a salesman, but he doesn't enlarge his spiritual life, right? So on page 36, it goes into what happens. He feels irritated, and suddenly the thought crosses his mind that if he were to put an ounce of whiskey in his milk, it couldn't hurt him, right? So that's the thing. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. And he believed the lie. He believed the lie that, you know what, right now, I'm just going to take the edge off, have a little time under my belt. What's the big deal, right? And guess what? It's not his fault. It's not his fault. He needed a larger spiritual life. And that's the prescription. Right. And Jim on page 35, and then we have Fred, right? And Fred's another example on page 39, the second full paragraph, where he's a partner in a well-known accounting firm. His income is good. There we go, worshiping income. He has a fine home, has a happy marriage. There's a relationship, right? And a father, and the father of promising children, college age. So he's looking good. He's looking real good. Right, he's got a good life, but guess what? He does the belief, the inner knowledge that, you know what? I'm an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. He came to the hospital to rest his nerve, right? So he drank, and everything was stable before drinking. He was a well-balanced individual, but when it came to alcohol, he was a goner. And he went to the hospital to rest his nerves because he believed, you know what, it's not that big of a deal. I'm just going to the hospital to rest my nerves. And self-knowledge would fix it on page 40. And boy, was he wrong. So I want to reiterate the fact that a physical step back does not mean a spiritual one, that we can have these moments of a relapse if you've relapsed. It doesn't mean it's inevitable, but I'm just saying if you are one of those people on the line who pick up, get back on track, pick up, get back on track, just because it's a physical step back, right, the bodily and mentally step back, it doesn't mean that it's a spiritual step back, meaning this, all of this is to continue to grow our spiritual life. We need these examples in order to once again be convinced that we have this thing. All those step backs are to vanish those lurking notions and reservations. We need that. That's part of our trail to get to the top. And when I want to say the top, this is what I mean. And I'm going to skip over to the top of page 60 and talk about step 12 real quick. And I know I'm jumping through the steps and not doing them in sequential order for time purposes and the tangents I've been on, but step 12 is really important. It's pretty much everything, right? So is every step. But step 12, having had a spiritual awakening. So now we're on the top. We are on the top of the mountain. We're on the summit. As a result of working these steps, right? So all our trials and failures and you know, bumps in the road and twisted ankles that it took to get to the top, right? We tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. And just because we're at the top, now it means that now we have to help others get to their top, right? And we, in order to do that, we got to go back down and we got to carry others up. We're never at the top. There is no summit. There's a false summit. Because we never fully graduate. We never fully say, we're done. No, we need to bring other people up. And I just remember on these hikes, it gets kind of lonely. It gets kind of quiet. It's like you can't even hear a pin drop. And then all of a sudden I hear like little voices and I'm like, oh my gosh, people are coming. Like, okay, good. So if anything happens, like we can just scream and someone's going to hear us. And that's what we all have here. Is that we're not alone. Like we can pick up and hear those voices whenever we want. And I just remember the exhale, right? That feeling of like, okay, like I don't have to do this alone. Like if something happens, it's okay. Those were my anchors. Those were my training wheels. And I also want to talk about how it works, right? Page 58, so I just went from 60 to 58, but how it works, this is how it works. This is the roadmap, right? So 59 is where the steps are, and I encourage anyone who hasn't read the steps, and even if you have, read them again, but they're in order for a reason, and that is the path. That is the path, and yes, we detour. I detour on a daily basis because I can make a decision to turn my will and my life over to God and then go on a complete detour where I am self-will run riot and things go south and it's not pretty. But guess what? I can then turn my will and my life over to God again in the same day. And I realize, whoa, I just went on a major detour, but I can straighten out. I can straighten out. So 86 and 88, those pages are crucial to me because it tells me exactly what to do throughout the day when I feel like I'm falling off course. So I read this every morning, and I'm just going to reiterate a couple things, right? That on awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. So every day I'm starting from the bottom of the mountain. Doesn't mean I'm on square one, it's step one or... Well, I'm always on step one, but it doesn't mean that I, you know, all the work that I put to get to that summit didn't count. No, it does count. It does count. I'm armored. You know, I have the strength. I have the momentum. So on awakening, I get to wake up again. I have these 24 hours. And last paragraph of 86, in thinking about my day, I may face indecision, right? I may not be sure which course to take. And here I ask God for inspiration, an intuitive thought or a decision. You know, what do I do next? Should I help someone today? Should I just keep to myself? Should I ignore my phone? I don't really feel like talking. Or I'm going to call someone I know won't pick up, but I'm going to leave a voicemail because then I really tried. And, you know, what am I going to do today? And then when I'm faced with indecision, I relax and take it easy. And after a while, the right answers come. What used to be the hunch or the occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind. The detours I take are less frequent. I'm more effective in my day, and I have more time under my belt to be helpful to others. As I'm not often diseased, going to every store, every drive-through, ordering takeout, I have more time to give back in my day. And then eventually, it's easy. It's like breathing. It becomes a working part of the mind. But still an experience in having just made conscious contact, it is not probable that we're going to be inspired at all times, right? Like, I want this title to my presentation immediately. I want to know, is the person I'm seeing the person I'm going to marry, right? I don't know. But nevertheless, I find that my thinking will, as time passes, plane of inspiration. We come to rely upon it. Eventually, I'm guided. I'm inspired. I'm kind of walking mindlessly, but I'm walking in the right direction. How is that? It's kind of like I'm floating, in not a, you know, majestic way, not in a unattainable way, right? I'm not flying, I'm not walking on water, but it's just kind of like I'm led. And I meditate, I close my eyes, I pause. I'm like, please show me throughout the day, like, what my next step is to be. And free me from self-will, right? When I'm in self-will, another detour. There I go again. But it happens. It's going to happen. I may ask myself, however, to pray if others will be helped. If I'm going to take a detour, then I want to find somebody else who's on that detour. I want to get back on track together. Let that detour be part of my story that catapults me to the place that I need to be spiritually. And then bottom of page 87, that last paragraph, as we go through the day, I pause and I say page 86 to 88 in the I form. So as I go through the day, I pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought or action. When I want to give up, when I'm like, I'm tired, I'm over it, right? I need to pause and ask for the right thought or action. Remind myself, I'm no longer running the show. Humbly saying to myself, many times each day, thy will be done. I'm in much less danger of excitement, fear, anger, worry, self-pity, or foolish decisions. I become much more efficient. I do not tire so easily, for I'm not burning up energy foolishly as I did when I was trying to arrange life to suit myself. It works. It really does. I have more energy. I'm not exhausted trying to arrange everything. It works. It really does. I am undisciplined, so I let God discipline me in the simple way I have just outlined. But that is not all. There is action and more action. We've got to keep hiking. We've got to keep hiking. Faith without works is dead. So all I can say to anyone on the path, to anyone trying to find the path, to anyone trying to start, anyone trying to continue, anyone who thinks they're on the summit and they're really not, and for those who are continuing to find others who are on a detour and bring them back, there is action and more action. And we've never made it. And I never really want to make it because I constantly want to seek something higher. I need it. I need it. And it is about the journey, and it's not about the destination, because my goodness, if this is as far as I'm supposed to be, yeah, it's good. But I want more. And it's okay to want more in terms of the spiritual realm. It's okay. I encourage all of us to seek more, because there's always higher heights to be reached. And that's all I have for this morning. Thank you for listening.
Thank you so much, Kelly, for your captivating, inspiring, and thought-provoking presentation this morning. Really beautiful. A wonderful and powerful message of hope and possibility. Thank you for your generous service this morning. The share ID for today's presentation, 22,899. That's 22899 for Kelly's presentation. Kelly's contact information will be given at the conclusion of this recording, so do stay tuned for that. And we will now transition to a question and answer segment. You can pose a question to Kelly, questions only, please, by pressing star one to unmute. I need your first name, including the first letter of your last name.
Anayeta R. Hanayeta R.
Yes, yes, Hanayeta. Anyone else?
Lauren Grace B, New Jersey.
Lauren Grace.
Sarah T.
Pete B.
Sarah T. Pete. Anyone else want to get in this lineup? Star one to unmute. All right, well, let's get started, beginning with a question from Hanayeta. Go ahead, please.
Okay, good morning. Good morning. Thank you, Leia, for your service. And Kelly G, I just am so amazed with what a beautiful presentation. I really liked what you said. Anything I think I'm, whenever I think I'm taking a shortcut, I really am taking a detour. I really like that. My question is, how do you expand on your spiritual growth? You talked about spiritual growth a lot and that you have to have that, but what do you do specifically to expand that, to make your horizon better?
Hi, thank you so much for the question. And that's a good question, right? You know, the way I enlarge my spiritual life is a lot of times doing the counterintuitive action that I really want to do. So for example, you know, I recently visited my family, which is incredibly dysfunctional, and the dysfunction is very comforting to me in some weird way, but I'm sure people can relate. And so I have to keep my mouth shut. Restraint of pen and tongue is enlarging my spiritual life, because it's realizing I'm doing something different and counterintuitive than what I really want to do. Another thing, right, in relationships, just doing things differently, knowing that this is what I would have done, and then this is what I'm doing. It also goes back to prioritizing my recovery, realizing, you know what, I don't got this thing. It's knowing that at the end of the day, when I'm working the entire day and the last thing I want to do is talk to anyone or get on a meeting, even a Zoom meeting, if I have to look at the computer screen again, but it's doing it anyway. It's doing it anyway. Also, helping somebody else. Sometimes I'm maxed out with my recovery, and I'm like, oh my goodness, I don't want to read anything. I don't want to talk to anyone. I'm not in the mood to do service. But it's also doing service in my everyday. It's holding the door for someone. I was at Costco a while ago, and this older woman was loading her car, and it's me going over there and helping her, thinking I'm in this false sense of a rush, and I'm not. I'm not. And I look for opportunities where I can just feel more connected, and that's always through action and more action. So that's how I would say that.
Thank you, Hanayeta R., for your question. Lauren Grace, your turn.
Good morning. Callie, this is Lauren Grace Beatty from New Jersey. Thank you so much for your share. I really got a lot from it. My question is, if you have a sponsee that picks up, loses their abstinence, or is in a short relapse, what do you do? Do you go back and start the steps again? What do you do with them?
Sure. Thanks for the question, Lauren. There is not a one-size-fits-all manual for this deal. So I really get to know my sponsee, and it depends if you feel like it's going to be helpful, right? Because we sponsor because we're trying to also save our own recovery. And in doing that, we help others. But if we feel like we can't be helpful to them anymore, then it's time for them to hear a new voice. I have a sponsee that, I worked through the steps again, right? Took a detour, then went to somebody else, then came back. And I feel like, you know what? We haven't exhausted everything. Like, I feel like there's more help that can be given, and I feel divinely led. But it's really a personal thing with you and that sponsee to think like, you know what? If you have given it your all, and you feel like if we were to just go back and then do the same thing, then, you have to make that call, because ultimately we have to be helpful. If we don't feel like it's going to be helpful, then it's probably not the right route. And also times, I think that even if you tried one way, maybe with the sponsee, maybe try doing the steps a different way with them and see if that helps, whether it be going through the big book one time and then the 12 and 12 another time. Sometimes I do that. So, it's more instinctual, and I would seek God and get quiet around it as well. But our goal is to be helpful. So whatever feels like you're going to be the most helpful.
Thank you, Lauren Grace. Sarah T.
Hi, good morning. This is Sarah T. from Louisville, Kentucky. And Kelly, I just can't even express how grateful I was for your talk today. And my question has been kind of already asked and answered, but I'm going to go ahead and ask it because it is slightly different in case if you have anything to add. And that is, I've been finding myself in my recovery kind of checking boxes. Like, okay, I've prayed and meditated. I sponsor a lot. And I go to meetings and I do this. And the analogy of the false summit really spoke to me. And, it's kind of related to the question about what do you do for your own spirituality. But when you find yourself in a rut, is there anything that you would add to that previous question to kind of like get out of that box checking place? Because I feel like I'm kind of keeping the responsibility for my recovery on me instead of God. So I just thought I'd see what you had to say to that. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks so much, Sarah. I think it's normal, like totally. And I feel that way often. Because we're routine people and structure people, and it's like that little girl in us sometimes where for me it's like, okay, I did it, check. Like, I did this, it's homework. And so I understand exactly how you feel, and sometimes it has to look a little different. Like, maybe your prayer and meditation looks like going for a walk in silence. I don't know, maybe it's stretching. Like, see, switch up, because I understand, and it just kind of, sometimes when I feel like that, I almost get like resentful that I have to do this. Like, oh, I'm sponsoring all these people and I do this prayer meditation and I just like, I'm not connected to it. And so first of all, accept where you're at, know that it's normal and common. And also just like, if you can, yeah, just switch things up perhaps and see if that helps. And also I sometimes feel like I'm kind of by the book with so many things, even when it comes to sponsoring. And I need to just kind of be divinely led with how I am talking with a sponsee, right? Where it's like, yeah, we can read the big book, but maybe they have something they need to talk about. And then maybe you have something that you can relate to. And then the session, I would say, when you're on the phone with a sponsee, like, doesn't directly go line by line through the big book, but it's like, whoa, like, we needed to talk about that. So maybe try to take the cookie cutter blueprint out of it and just switch things up, whatever that looks like. But just know I understand. And I get it. So stay the course, you know, it's a phase. It's temporary how you feel. And just see where you can do things a little bit different.
Thank you, Sarah T. Pete B., your turn.
Thanks, Leah, for your service. Really appreciate it. And thank you, Kelly. That was really good. I really like the stories and the analogies. You're a good storyteller and very articulate. So the book talks about, or could you talk about what proper use of the will looks like for you and how, and more about what being restored to sanity looks and feels like?
Yeah, of course. Great to hear you, Pete. Thank you for the question. Yeah, so self-will, I'll give you an example. Or maybe this is more the honesty policy, but with work, I can expense mileage, right? And so there was a trip that I took for work. And if I drove, it was to Orlando from where I live in Fort Lauderdale. And you can expense it if you drive. And so I didn't drive. I drove with a friend who drove. And when I go to expense my miles for the month, I started putting like, yeah, we went to Orlando as if I drove and it was my mileage, but it wasn't. So guess what? I didn't expense that, but I wanted to, right? So self-will is like, I'm going to expense that. I'm going to do that. Like, that's what I want. It's like a little bit of free money, but it's like, no, I can't live like that today. So my will is kind of wired like, what can I get away with? But then I realized, well, I'm not really getting away with anything. Because sure, I can get paid that little bit extra, $100 for gas or whatnot. But my gosh, that pebble in my shoe, that feeling of knowing like that's not it. Like that's not how I want to feel. And no amount is worth it. Another self-will, is wanting to get my way. I'm trying to think of an example that, I mean, this happens like on the daily, so it's funny that it's escaping me, but Thanksgiving's coming up, right? And in this new relationship, I want him to come for Thanksgiving. And he said he was going to come for Thanksgiving. And then all of a sudden it's like, well, he may go to his family. And it's like, what do you mean you may go to his family? You may go to your family, right? And so it's like, I want my will. I want things my way. And it's, I can't insert that. I can't. I'm going to push people away. I have to let it go. I have to let that go. And a lot of it, and I sound like a broken record, is restraint and pen and tongue. I want to chew people out. I want revenge when they bother me. I want to scream when things don't go my way. And, oh, just this is a funny one. I went to a concert the other day, and Pete, I'm sorry if I'm digressing, and I hope this helps in any way, shape, or form, but I went to a concert the other day and I have these great seats and this woman decides, the woman in front of me, that she wants to stand up the whole concert and dance. And I was just like, you've got to be kidding me. And I tapped her on the shoulder. I go, hey, you know, would you mind sitting down? And she says, no, I'm not going to sit down. And I felt like tears, you know, building in my eyes. And I was like, you've got to be kidding me. Like, I can't believe she just said no. And guess what? I got up and I walked to different seats and I said to myself, you know what? I'm going to sit here until somebody comes. And they were the best seats and I had the best view and nobody came. And I was so grateful to that woman for standing up because, and she was the catalyst for that. So Pete, I hope that helps. There was a second part of your question that I didn't remember and I probably didn't answer. So we can totally talk on the phone.
You're
but
good.
Thanks so much for the question.
Thank you.
Thanks, Pete. Who else has a question this morning for Kelly? You can do so by pressing *1 to unmute. I need your name as well as the first letter of your last name. Great opportunity to pose a question. Jeannie B.
Herbert F.
Herbert. Anyone else?
Jason Casey.
A. Jason K. And who else is that?
Brenda A. New York.
Brenda. Okay.
Brenda.
Excellent.
Thank you
so much. Jeannie B., go ahead with your question. Thank you.
Good morning. Thanks, everyone who makes this meeting possible. My question is, when you were listing out, Kelly, the things that you had gotten that you thought, like, this is it, I've got the guy, I've got the job, I've got all this stuff, I was wondering, as you faced recovery and all that, were you able to maintain those things, or were those things that you had to release along the way? And I guess there was a part of me that was like, wow, she hit all these heights. I wonder where the like tipping point came, because it seems like you, in a conventional sense, had it all. Thank you.
Yeah, amazing, amazing question. The thing is, no, like when I mentioned that whole list, I have even more than that list today. But the thing is that I don't give all that power to that list. That's not what I'm worshiping. What I'm worshiping is God's will, what God has for me. And all those things, right, the relationship, the job, the financial security, the apartment that I live in, the view that I have, all that's a byproduct of when I put God first. Because all those things that I listed, I lose without putting God first. It's all fleeting. It's all temporary. So I have all those things and more if I don't give the power and worship those things. And what changed for me when I did have it all, right, when I thought I made it, was that I didn't have that connection with God. It's I worshiped all those things and that had all the power, and I was chasing a moving train because I just wanted more and more and more. Nothing was ever enough, because that empty spiritual hole can never be filled with the material things, with another human, with money. None of it. It doesn't matter, because it's all an inside job. And today I do have beautiful things and I do have a beautiful life, but my insides match my outsides. Before, the outsides were just trying to cover and hide and disguise the brokenness on the inside. And today I can have it all. And truly, having it all does not mean all those material things. It really doesn't, because I've tasted that before. And it is the most empty feeling inside. And so I know that when I'm in a funk, buying something expensive is not the answer. And I'm grateful that I know that today, right? I know I'm an alcoholic, which I know I'm compulsive overeater, right? It's I know who I am. So I know that that's not going to be my solution. It's always going to be God. And when God is that solution, the byproduct of that, the list is endless of beautiful things.
Thank you, Jeannie B. Next up, Herbert F. Your question, please.
Thank you. Good morning. Appreciate the share. Could you please explain a slip? What does a slip mean to you? And how do you recognize that, and what do you do about it, either for you or your sponsee?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for the question. I personally don't believe in slips. I think it's like you pick up or you don't pick up. I say it's like you're pregnant or you're not pregnant. So there's like the slip. It's like, yeah, you could be off plan, but, you know, it's a relapse. You know, it's hard for me to say that in such an extreme form, but, you know, a slip is a slip, which is like, it sounds to me like a diet. It's like, oh, I had like a bite of chocolate, you know, I slipped, I had a piece of the birthday cake, but now I'm back. And it's like, well, no, did you forget who you are? Because that's the foundation of it. A slip is almost like not admitting who we are. A slip is a diet, in my opinion. This is all my opinion, by the way. But this is like how I think about it, where it's like a slip is not taking ownership for the fact that like there's some piece of my spiritual fitness, there's some piece of the program or the steps that has a bit of a crack. So Fonsi, it's totally a personal preference in terms of how you proceed, but there's something where there's a crack in the foundation. So the slip is going to keep happening, which, I mean, a slip, a relapse, they're all synonyms, but, you know, you have to decide with your sponsee what that looks like. Because for me, like, I don't want to water down the program. I don't want to say, oh, okay, you had a slip. All right, well, let's just keep going. Like, let's just keep moving on. It happened. It depends in a sense, but also, like, it needs to be taken seriously because it is serious. And this disease is progressive. So a slip is a slippery slope. And that's what I got.
Thank you, Herbert F. Jason KP, your turn.
Jason KP, and apologies if this is a repeat. I was fading in and out with baby care. The concept of a pink cloud, just kind of curious if you meant, I always took that to mean a spiritual high, but it sounds like you were indicating like a high of like ego achievements or attainment or pride. So tell me more about that, why it's an important concept, why. You know, I don't necessarily see it in the big book, but why? What's the usefulness of bringing up that concept, if you don't mind speaking more about it?
Yeah, of course. Thanks for the question. And yeah, it does not say it in the big book. It's kind of what I heard I kind of hear it often, but like that pink cloud, when you hear someone, for me, it's more in the beginning where I hear people who are like just started and are like 3 days in. And you just kind of, oh, my God, this is great. I love it. Like, I'm getting along with my husband and, like, I'm in the best mood and I held the door open for someone. It's just kind of like, for me, it's that pink cloud. It's the honeymoon phase. That's what I'm talking about, where it's that honeymoon phase where, like, everything's good. Like, the sun is brighter than usual. The trees are greener. It's just kind of like I'm in this euphoric state of, like, oh, my goodness, now, like, I can't believe this exists. Like, I can't believe this program exists and everyone's so nice. And like, I met the nicest person and, you know, it's just, I don't want to say it's a calm before the storm because that's like so negative, but it's like, it's just the beginning, right? And then the truth comes out where we have to look at ourselves on step four and realize like, oh shoot, like we were a tornado. And then we got to look at those defects that are keeping us sick, right, and fueling the disease. And then we got to face these people and make amends. So it's like there's a lot of work to be done. And things just like in the beginning, it is exciting, but it's like living in this brand new house, right? It's like that pink cloud, but then like a light bulb goes out and then the air conditioning breaks and then there's a snowstorm and there's no heat and we don't have a generator. And then it's like it all is like exciting in the beginning until like things happen. So that's what I was referring to in terms of a pink cloud in the beginning. It's just there's a lot of work to be done.
Thank you, Jason. And Brenda A. has our final question for this morning. Go ahead, Brenda.
Good morning. Thank you all for your service. And Kelly, thank you for touching my heart and my soul. Kelly, one of my questions is, and I don't recall you talking about this, either as a sponsee or a sponsor, I am coming to terms with my rigidity. There's only one way to do it. And if you, I don't know if you ever felt that way, but if you did, if you could elaborate on it and how you stepped out of it.
Yeah, definitely. You know, rigidity kind of goes back to like doing the counterintuitive where, you know, for me, I like to eat out at the same place every single time I eat out. I like it. I'm comfortable with the menu. I love what I love. You know, I enjoy the meal and it's kind of rigid. It's like, well, does it matter the company I'm with, or like, do I just want to go to that set restaurant and whoever wants to join joins, right? So it's the rigidity of like kind of doing the counterintuitive, like trying to be flexible, you know, like today I'm not going to be able to work out this morning, and then tomorrow I'm not going to be able to, and then Tuesday is going to be a late. So it's just like, yeah, like I'd love to work out and like love to have the time for it, but like I don't. And so it's just kind of accepting, like, I'm not going to die. Like, I'm not going to die. And I'm working this way of life, and it doesn't have to be so tight that I'm going to be okay, right? Because then I'm playing God. If my hands are, clenched so tight and I'm holding on to things, right, there's something that I'm not letting go. I'm trying to control something, because that's rigidity, is control. So I would encourage you to kind of take a look and see like what comes up for you when something is a little bit tweaked. Like what comes up for you? What's that fear? Because I think underneath that rigidity is a lot of fear. So that's what I would take a look at. And it feels kind of good to do something different. Like when I do try a new restaurant, I realize like, oh my gosh, like that meal was great too. It was so nice to have something different. You know, when I do that, it's like, it feels really good, and it gives me confidence to then, you know, do the next thing. It has that domino effect, you know, but I understand what it's like to be safe, and safety comes from that routine, and safety can also come from that rigidity. So it's normal, and I get it, and I hear you. But try to get to the underneath, take it a step further and figure out like what's the fear behind that. And that's what I have. Thanks for the question.
Thank you, Brenda A., for your question. Thanks to all who posed questions this morning. And, of course, thank you to our speaker, Kelly G. Thank you for offering so much of yourself, Kelly. Wonderful and profound presentation this morning. Appreciate your service. The share ID for today, 22,899. That's 22899. Let's close now. From page 164, it's found in a chapter entitled A Vision for You. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. After the morning meditation, what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your fault to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God